Welcome to another episode of In the Name of Service, a podcast committed to sharing the untold stories of those who selflessly serve. Each episode features an interview with men and women who have been called to a variety of service-focused roles, such as the military, law enforcement, ministry, volunteering, and more. You aren't likely to know the names of the individuals you meet here, but our hope is by the end of our time together, you'll not only know their stories, but possibly be inspired to write your own in some way. Humble in nature, but strong in character, these everyday men and women showcase what it is to truly be a servant. We're glad you're here. Now here's your host, Dr. Barb Thompson.
All right. Thank you so much for joining me today for another inspiring episode of In the Name of Service. I'm your host, Dr. Barb Thompson. As a United States Army veteran and operational psychologist, I've spent my career working with military and law enforcement units, conducting in-depth interviews with hundreds of individuals who are hoping to earn their place on high-risk, high-performing teams. In most cases, they've already put in years of grueling physical and mental work just to get the chance to serve and sacrifice more. And that type of selflessness is special, and I feel worthy of recognition. While each person's story is unique and every path to service different, their goals are similar: to do something more, to be part of something bigger, and to make a difference. These difference makers were the catalyst behind this podcast, and it's my privilege to share their stories with you. Today, I get to introduce my friend and former colleague, Celeste McVeigh. So we had the opportunity to work together at an Air Force Special Operations Unit, and very high pace, lots of really important work that we got to do together, but it wasn't long enough. That's my only gripe.
Me too.
But I'm so glad that we've kept in touch, because you are just everywhere you go. And y'all don't know this about Celeste yet, but when she walks in the room, it's as if someone has opened the window. Like, it is just, she's a bright shining light. So Celeste, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay. Thank you so much, Barbara. I'm so glad to be here. I'm just pleased that you asked me, and you know, we can talk a little bit and I can share a little bit about myself and, you know, what's kind of guided me in my life. And so I guess, you know, I grew up in Texas. So I grew up, both of my parents, native Texan, like, I guess that's the terminology that people prefer to use, native anyway. My dad was born and raised in Fort Worth. My mother was born and raised in Waco. And I have an older sister. And biologically, she is my half-sister. My mother was previously married. She, like many people for her time, she married her high school sweetheart. And remarkably, still saw her way to get a bachelor's degree on time from Baylor University. She went to like her hometown school and went straight into a master's degree program, which is, you know, pretty remarkable for that time as well, because she pretty quickly after my sister Laurie was born, they separated and divorced. So she was a single mom pretty quickly. And my dad went to VMI, and he graduated, and as did everyone in that class that he graduated with in 1966, everybody commissioned.
Yeah.
Everybody was going, and he got through Ranger School and graduated from Ranger School in 67. I've tried to find his Ranger picture, but you know, back in the day, they weren't necessarily taking like staged pictures after people completed, you know, the whole experience. So that I haven't been successful at finding that for him. But, anyway, he was, stationed with the 101st Airborne and deployed very quickly to Vietnam. So when he got back from Vietnam, and he was injured while he was overseas, he decided to just take a different path, and he went to law school at Baylor. And that's how my parents met. And
then, wow. They're a bunch of smarties.
Isn't that wild?
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're smarties. Well, they're pretty driven people, I think. For sure. And so I grew up, you know, in Fort Worth initially. And then I think pretty significantly, once my dad finished law school and got a job in Fort Worth, and that's where my parents and my sister relocated. I think for sure that's when the PTSD for him really started taking a hold. And he just was really struggling. And so my parents' marriage struggled, and he was kind of in and out of the house quite a lot. And so then my parents finally divorced when I was 5. And so my mom was a single parent. She was working as a high school English teacher. English is a second language. And we were like surviving.
Right.
Barely. We were surviving.
Yeah.
And barely. And I'm not saying that I don't think my father didn't contribute financially. I mean, he did. But I mean, it was just hard living at that time. And also, my mom had started a PhD program at TCU. So there's that. And I think my sister, who's about 7, almost 8 years older than I am, we were just discussing that last night. I was like, like a primary caretaker for me. And I sure that, you know, that wasn't necessarily as a teenager what she preferred to do.
Right, right.
But I think she did a lot of taking care of me.
Yeah.
And then my mother met my stepfather at a high school reunion from Waco High. If you like, they knew each other in high school, and then they kind of re-met at a high school reunion. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
Yeah. And both were divorced and then started a relationship. Well, so then the year that my sister left for college, she went to Randolph-Macon Women's College in Lynchburg, Virginia. We moved to San Antonio. I moved, you know, by myself. So that was that was hard because my sister left and she was kind of this
mother figure. Yeah.
For me, if you will. Yeah, for sure. So we moved to San Antonio, and initially I went to this really nice school that was all Montessori based.
Oh, wow.
And because my mother really believed in Montessori, mm-hmm. you know, I went to a Montessori preschool, and so she found this school, and it lived in this like amazing old man. I mean, it was, you know, a mansion by all stretch of the imagination. And it was in Almas Park, San Antonio. And so it was quite a commute from where we had purchased a house out kind of like what was then the outskirts of San Antonio. And so I went to this like Montessori school for up until the time I went into seventh grade into the public school. Isn't that really bizarre?
It is
a lot.
I can totally see it, though. I can totally see it. You're a free spirit,
yeah.
Celeste. So I can see that working for you. And then public school being like, you know, like being thrown into ice water or something. Yeah. What do you think?
Yeah. And
yeah, go ahead.
Well, and the interesting thing too about the Montessori school, which I really loved, is every year our teacher, who was this like larger than life, I think he was Danish or Swedish. know, I'm really messing that up, I'm sure. He was Scandinavian, okay? His parents were the owners and operated the school, so this is their son, and he taught our class. And he would have us put on full-on Shakespeare productions every year.
I love it.
You?
That's so cool.
Imagine. Yeah. No, it was so fun. Yes.
Yes. You say it was fun. I probably would have died.
Like, we put a lot of stress.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah. What do you think it was about? Like, what are some things you think about your childhood and the way you grew up that lended themselves or kind of steered you towards serving, you know, others in the role of a, you know, licensed clinical social worker? Or I'm sure it wasn't.
Well, I feel like, you know, I had such a strange, like the dichotomy of my life was very strange. So, you know, we lived in the suburbs of San Antonio, and my mother worked like all the time. And because that was her outlet.
Right.
She traveled for a living. So she was gone a lot. And my stepfather worked a lot, and he is like, on the spectrum of introvert and extrovert, he's like way over on the introverted side of things. And so I spent a lot of time by myself.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would go visit my dad. I always saw him very regularly. He never didn't see me, you know? Yeah. But I would go out there, and we lived like in the woods of East mm-hmm. Texas. And he, you know, I helped him strip pine logs for at least a year every time I'd go out and see. I was working. I was out right. in the woods yeah. and I was working yeah. and we built his cabin. I helped him build his cabin. And he was just going through the paces of his own struggle and still managing to go to work and be this like presence in this very small town in East Texas, and really caring about what he was contributing to the community and really not doing very well. But I didn't understand that. Like I just yeah. knew things around me were very strange, you know? And
you mean none of your friends were
in San Antonio
making cabins?
Yeah.
You mean they had running water, Celeste?
Yeah, no. 100%. They had running water, and it was the 80s, you know, they right. were like going to the yeah. mall and going to
MTV,
the movies.
Baby.
And not that I didn't, right. And not that I didn't do some of that. Of course, when I got home, I had that, but you know, my mother was, I think I can definitively say that I grew up in an environment where like, no one ever asked me, like what I wanted.
Yeah.
You know, there wasn't this,
wow.
I was living up to other people's, I mean, everybody else was driving the boat. I wasn't really right. driving the boat, you know?
Yeah.
And I was just kind of, as I guess most children do, you know, you're like, there's this expectation you have to adjust. And it was pretty, I mean, I think about it, I'm like, oh God, that was pretty severe, you know? And then my dad would pick me up and we'd go to Big Bend for 2 solid weeks every year. And it was just, you know, I was bathing in the Rio Grande River. And I mean, we were out in the boonies, you know?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It was wonderful. I think about the departure that allowed me. But I think as I got older and I recognized not only that these really challenging life experiences were affecting my own parents. I mean, that doesn't come till later. But I started being curious about like why I wasn't doing so great.
Yeah, right.
I think it's interesting what brings us to the profession, right?
Because oh, I know.
I do think mm-hmm. genuinely it's about trying to find answers to our own questions.
Right.
Really, yeah. That's just fair. And I had a lot, you know, and I went on different iterations of that journey throughout my lifetime. You know, I went to Duke Divinity School and had the great pleasure of studying there and getting my master's in theological studies. But because I think I had some existential questions I need to answer for myself, and was exposed to so many different thought processes about what the spiritual life looked like and how it could benefit you. So, you know, I grew up in the Episcopal Church. My mother was very involved. I was very involved, but I was also visiting my father, and he was kind of going off on this Eastern religion journey. And which I really loved, you know, but I went to divinity school because I basically was told by the bishop at the time. And I mean, I just was not making a lot of decisions for myself.
Yeah.
So
when did that change?
When I came to going to school, that changed. Well, I think, one of the things I think that changed that is that I graduated from divinity school. I was like very lost. And I got a job opportunity that was offered to me out in the Diocese of Hawaii. And I just knew that if I got offered that position, I was going to take it.
Yeah.
And at this point, I was already dating my husband. He was stationed at Fort Benning now.
Okay.
And yeah, he had left Fort Bragg, went to Fort Benning. I met him while we were in North Carolina. And I was still like, I got to go. I really need to do something that's just completely out of my element. And so I did. I went to Hawaii and had such an excellent experience there with the people of that lovely community. I mean, it was awesome. Certainly, I learned a lot about communication there. I learned a lot about communication there because it was so different than this paced, kind of frantic communication in the U.S.
Yeah.
And relationship was number one in Hawaii. So you didn't do anything before you did the work of building relationship with people. And I loved that. You know, so that was so huge for me. And I think I felt that was a major bump of growth. And then I moved there in July of 2001. And then September 11th happened. September 11th happened.
Yeah.
And which was wild. But very soon after that happened, I think my husband at that time, like we had been friends for 2.5 years and we had started dating finally. And I think we just kind of knew.
Right.
We finally were like, what are we doing? Why are we not? You know, like this serious thing just happened. Let's get going. Let's speed it up.
Yeah. Time for the old ball and chain.
And right. So then we got married, and then I went on this great adventure called, you know, being a military spouse.
For the entirety of the GWAT.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. I think about that a lot. Yeah. I think about that a lot. Especially for all of our service members of that time.
Yeah.
I mean,
so your whole,
you know, being
marriage,
at work for 20 years.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And he was very busy. Mm-hmm. Do you mind telling like his profession?
Oh yeah. So he was an ER trauma nurse.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think it was so interesting, you know, when you sent me the questions and you were like, okay, what are these things that kind of shaped you? And I thought a lot about, you know, the many trips I took to Big Bend with my dad and how that impacted me, and and all the adventures that we experienced together. And then I thought a lot about like what my husband experienced, because I think it's impossible to say it's not my experience, but they affect you as a military spouse in a way that's very real and worthy of acknowledging.
Absolutely. You know? Yes.
And so my husband had been talking to me for a long time. I think I was considering hospital chaplaincy for a while. So when we were stationed at Fort Hood, I was driving for one semester back and forth to the seminary in Austin and taking some classes. And I think he just was so encouraging. I think he just always was like, you know, this mental health world, I think, is where you're going to find your path.
Yeah.
And I was very resistant. I was like,
that's so funny.
I was like, I don't really have anything to contribute. You know, I mean, I think wow. I really felt that. Like, I didn't feel like there was a lot for me to offer. And, you know, I think there's this fear too that we haven't done enough work on ourselves to actually be a presence for others.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're like, but and I'm the broken one here.
Yeah. 100%. Right. Like, yeah. I still am really dealing with all of my own stuff. And I, which is never ending though, by the way, like
of
you're
course.
Never finished yes. with that work.
Yes.
Never. Yes. And I still struggle with that. Like, I still have to do my due diligence. And I think with time in the career, I've, like, you know, learned better what I need to do for myself in order to stay healthy and well. You know?
Yeah.
But it's not easy because you're, like, raising children. You're working on your own marriage. I mean, yeah, there's nothing harder than the work you do in marriage and parenting.
Right.
I just
100% agree. Yeah.
It's so hard.
What would you say based on like your experience, the challenges that you and your family faced living this lifestyle and committed, you know, you guys committed to one another, obviously like your husband committed to whatever mission, you know, he needed to be on at the time. What would you say was your greatest challenge?
I think there's this place, there's this space in marriage or partnership that it's so delicate. It's this very delicate balance of being together, you know, on the journey itself, but also allowing space for individual experiences and not trying to make it your own. You know, I really, and then being okay with just letting each other have these very differing experiences. I just didn't know what to do with deployments. Like, I didn't know what to think about them. I didn't necessarily know how to not just like lose my mind when we did have the opportunity to get on the phone, like, because I was experiencing my own thing.
Right.
And here's what's been happening. You have your yeah, right. Meanwhile, I know you're at Bagram, but And I'm not trying to say that was every conversation, but I, you know, you lean so much on your partner. If you really have this dynamic between the two of you where you're really relying on one another for like holding space for each other with love,
then their absence is
you know,
a big deal.
That's
right.
Oh, It's so huge. And then you're dealing with the children and their own grieving process.
Right.
With
of course. Yeah.
It was wild.
Fear of the unknown. Yeah. I agree.
Yes.
What would you say has been your most treasured reward? You know, it is a privilege, I think, to go through all those experiences and, you know, remain an intact family. It's almost rare.
But
So what would you, even though it's painful at times, what do you treasure about being able to serve in that way?
Oh, gosh. I think it's an opportunity, you know, just like any kind of life challenge or any experience that you find yourself in, it does end up being an opportunity. I mean, you're not maybe necessarily categorizing it that way when you're in it, you know?
Yeah.
But if you can find space to utilize it, so show up for other spouses, show up for other children, show up for each other. I mean, I could not, I just feel like that community I managed to surround myself with, I felt fortunate that way. It wasn't a lot of people, but the few military spouses that I did gravitate towards, and we were able to be there for one another, and maybe they were more there for me. I don't know if they would say them very much, but I certainly feel they impacted my life tremendously.
Yeah.
And I just, that is that knowledge that you can create those connections. You can come back together as a family and navigate forward, even though it's painful at times. We have all benefited, and it shaped us. We're different people because of it. Even the kids.
Yeah. Right.
And I don't mean that like, oh, we built resiliency and it was worth it. I'm not trying to minimize it, because I don't think it's not hard, you know?
Right. Yeah.
But
you can see the growth. Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
Oh, for sure. And, you know, and then my husband's retirement was a whole nother obstacle we had to navigate, which is also not easy, you know?
No.
So there's,
no.
I mean, you.
And the more I talk to people, even more difficult sometimes than, so, right. Well, speaking of holding space, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, like, you know, these service members, many of them, you know, they started this journey at the age of 17 or 18, you know,
my
husband enlisted at 17, you know, went to boot camp his summer before his senior year of high school. And I think, like, you know, when it's all you've known,
right?
What is the process?
It's so terrifying. Yeah.
It's enormous. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. The whole, like, he's just figuring out who he is while weaving in, you know, the army thing. That's part of who he is. And once he's out, like, who is he now? Yeah. It's a huge part of. I mean, and it's hard, right, to reinvent yourself or to put away that identity.
It's so hard.
Yeah. Or to find something, you know, you've been in and on teams where people are literally willing to give their life to save yours. And that's hard to find, too. So.
Oh, I know. And then how do you even build relationship and connection? Like, it's just so hard for them.
Yeah. You've just knowing about the work that you've done, you know, with trauma and addiction and everything, you've held space for people in their most painful times, and you're good at it. That can be difficult. That can be a lot to hold. So what do you think keeps you going during those times? And and still just available, willing, and ready to continue serving in the way that you do?
I love that question because I spent a lot of time thinking about that one, because I think I was terrible initially. I think I was terrible at it when I first started. You know, I was just pounding away, you know, at job and didn't have this awareness. And, you know, that has to do with my own life experience. You know, we are shaped by our own life experience. And I think I didn't, it took me a long time to understand that I had to prioritize my own needs. So that comes from way back, you know, mm-hmm. And the profession itself, I think, has actually helped me get to a better place where I can say, okay, I need to take some time off. I need to go for a really long walk in the woods. I need to spend all day in the kitchen cooking, if that's what I so choose to do. Like I, and then again, you know, you've got to have a marriage that allows for that space too.
Yeah.
Right. So that was a huge thing. I think my husband and I learned that we needed to do for one another. We just, what do you need to go to? You need to go for a run? Great, go do that. I am going to go do some, I'm going to, you know, do some cross stitch. You know, like I like to do needlepoint every once in a while. And, you know, another one thing that I really love is bird watching. So So this year, oh my gosh, I've gotten so much better at this. Like this year I have scheduled out opportunities for me to like spend time with my sister, go on a bird watching trip, like see my kids during their parents' weekend. Like you just have to remember, like there's this whole other life over here and it's yours.
And what do you think those things have done for your professional
really,
life?
Yeah. Oh, I think I can keep moving forward. I mean, it is tremendous the amount that we hold witness to for others. Mm-hmm. The acuity of a lot of my clients is very real. Mm-hmm. And there's no way, even though you hold very good boundaries, there's just no way you're not going to be penetrated.
Yeah.
By those stories. There's just no way.
Right.
And totally. And I certainly fell down the terrible narrative that I was not being affected. I mean, I don't know if I would have articulated it that way, but I just thought, you know, I can take it. I can just mm-hmm. take it and take it and take it and take it. And, you know, like what a lie that was.
Yeah.
You know,
well, and it's almost
and it was certainly yeah
like as an outsider looking in on your life, like mm-hmm. for you to be able to just take it and take it and take it almost takes the humanness away from the pain, you know, that people are feeling. And so that you have to take time away and process it yourself almost honors, you know, their pain in a way that's different. Then it's just a job. This is just what I do for a living. So I appreciate
yes.
talking about that and just hearing it. So your work gives you this behind the scenes. I mean, obviously you've lived with your own experience of being a military spouse for many, many, many years. But you also get to view the struggles of our military members and couples and families that they all endure. So considering all you've learned so far, what advice or resources would you recommend? Just, you know, just a few.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So I love that question too. I think we have to remember that if we're only treating the one person, we're really missing the larger picture. okay? Right. Because none of us function in a bubble, you know? And so when we talk about the whole health of the force, we should also be utilizing and applying that same thought process to the family or who that individual is moving towards for that love and support and space for vulnerability and healing. Okay.
Yeah.
So yeah. I think we have to think about it that way. It's not just like you need to go to counseling or you need to go to therapy. It's like we all probably need to do some tending to ourselves. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I've been really fortunate. You know, in the clinic where I work currently, I have been able to like still see a lot of, you know, people from the soft community that are retired. And I have some active duty people, and I certainly prioritize spouses. And mm-hmm. I've seen some dependents in the past. I would say don't be fearful of the process. I think what people do is they get in their heads and they think, well, clinicians are going to not only will they not understand, but they mean us harm in some
right.
way.
Yeah.
And they're taking such a close accounting that they're out to take our lives away from us. Like,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it can get very distorted. And you also have to think that, you know, a lot of the people in the soft community are already, they already lean towards being hypervigilant and a little
yeah.
paranoid. You
know? Right.
And so,
wait, this is a tad bit cynical.
I just encourage. Right. And you just want to encourage people that, I also want to acknowledge that you might go to somebody and it might not, you might not hit it out of the park the first time, you know, you
yeah.
have to be intentional with finding the right therapist or mental health clinician to address what it is you need. And you have to get
yeah.
comfortable with them before anything
right.
else. And
yeah.
so you have to trust yourself, but don't talk yourself out of understanding that, you know, being, intentional with your
care, basically,
a normalizing conversation about,
mm-hmm.
you know, maybe we need some support. Maybe we need some outside eyes on our set of circumstances so we can move forward in health, you know? And so
yeah.
holistic is really important. So I think marriage counseling is fantastic. It's not just for the people that are trying to like, you know, end their time together. It really is
right.
about resetting. Okay. And,
mm-hmm.
And getting your children some support, you know,
yeah.
it's okay. It's okay. Like, I think that becomes very frightening for some
right.
people. And ask your unit. The unit has so many resources available. There are all kinds of opportunities to get the care you need. I mean, Military OneSource is fantastic. The Military Spouse Advocacy Network is so good. There's a website called Military Kids Connect, and it's like this opportunity for kids who are also military to speak with one another, you know, in a forum
that's so cool.
safe. Yeah, it's, I mean, there's so many things, and
yeah,
you'd be surprised. I mean, but just once you start functioning in a tunnel with your blinders on and you don't feel like there are choices, things
right.
are not good.
Not good.
Things are not
yeah.
good. So I tell people that a lot, you know.
And it feels like that. It does feel like that. And it takes such courage and vulnerability to step out. And say, hey, I'm struggling with this. And so sometimes if it doesn't work out right out of the gate, it can, you know, you have the temptation to put up those blinders again and say, yep, I was right. But what you're saying is like, hey, like, it's just like trying on shoes, sure. You know, sometimes I, you know, wear one size in one brand and another size in another. But you've worked with, you know, some of the country's most elite warriors. So what I'm hearing is that even these like superhumans struggle.
Oh, for sure. Listen, I mean, you know, we're, again, one of the reasons I've really enjoyed working with the veterans from those communities out here in the outside world, you know, with my, in my clinic, is that there's this entire process that they engage that is about curiosity. Well, that's what, at least what I work with them on. If you have been a part, I like to categorize them, I think it's a whole nother level of intensity. You have to recognize that the care that you have to take of yourself forever is a real thing.
Yeah.
Okay. Because it is a very unique, extraordinary experience. And it has, you know, I always think of you when I use this term, Barb, it has a price. Okay. And the price is, and I don't mean price in a negative way. I think we all make our decisions in life. Okay. Every one of us, but none of those decisions don't impact us very deeply. So not acknowledging that there is an impact that needs attention is not a fair assessment. You know, it's not fair. And I think people want quick and fast. I think there's this idea that, and I understand this within training, to be in some of those elite units, you are encouraged to feel limitless. And in truth, they employ that, you know, when they go out and do their job.
Right.
But but unfortunately we do have limits. You know, we do have a time where those experiences start manifesting.
Right.
So whether that's in your physical health, whether that is in somatic pain in your gut or in your joints, I mean, it's very deep. So it's not fair to be like, oh, I'm not a complex person like everybody else. Well, you are. You are a very complex person.
Yeah.
And that's okay. That's really okay. You know? And to take good care means that you're still engaging in the world. And we all want those people to be here with us.
Oh,
you know,
my gosh.
They have people that love them. And engaging in the world is so needed by these warriors. We want them to be here with us. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's just so important to say that everyone struggles, even the most elite, and that's just the human experience. So there's no shame in struggle. It just proves you're human. So let's say that someone listening to your story can identify, you know, and maybe they want to be in mental health profession, maybe they don't, but they do feel a call to serve in some, you know, way that's unique to themselves, but they don't know how or where to get started. What would your advice be for them?
Oh, yeah. I think, well, just start. We have patients that ask me questions about my own journey and like and how I got started. I think that's exceptional. I think, you know, I ended up doing an online program. I went through the University of Southern California, and when they, you know, I don't know, they just kind of spearheaded this opportunity to make education more available. And, you know, there were a ton of military spouses in my cohort, of course, because we're all looking for opportunities, and which was really wonderful. And a lot of veterans, actually, in my cohort. And then there were a lot of regular civilians, too. But I think I did that program. I went back to back 4 semesters. I finished in 1.5 years. I just kind of wanted to dive in and get it done, you know, and then spent 1 year doing my field placement at the trauma recovery program at the Fayetteville VA, which was an excellent experience. I got tremendous guidance and support, and my clinical supervision was fantastic. And I think you know, just trust the process, but get yourself out there and get some information. Start calling schools. I'm currently helping a service member try to figure out the next step for them, you know, as they want to move into the mental health world and what schools look best. And I think we're all just kind of like, and his choices looked very different than mine, because he's a very different person than me, you know. But just reach out for that support, you know, and make some calls. You'd be shocked at what kind of resources are also out there to get you back into school. Even if you have to take out the student loan, the important thing is that we are investing in ourselves. Investment in yourself is never going to go to waste, ever.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And we're worthy of that. People get really worried about like taking out the student loan or having the resources available. And it's totally doable. It's totally mm-hmm. doable. It's worth it. If you want it and it's time for you to make that. I mean, I went back to school in my 40s. I mean,
right.
I don't know.
Right.
You know, we all arrive where we are at different times in our life. Yeah.
Right. And what are your thoughts now? You know, earlier you said, at the time, you didn't think that you had anything to contribute.
Oh, gosh. Well, I'm better able to, like, I know, right? I still struggle.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I'm better able to recognize some of the things. You know,
yeah.
I think, like, I do have this awareness that really essential to a good a very good and productive therapeutic environment.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't really engage. I just don't have a tendency. I mean, maybe in my personal life, certainly, because I'm just human. But in my professional life, I have no room for assumptions or judgment.
Right.
It just doesn't even occur to me.
Right.
I have learned, especially in working with people that struggle with addiction, and that's all kinds of addictions, but you just cannot, it is such a waste of your energy and time to try to figure people out before you give them the opportunity to share themselves with you. It's just not, it's not even worth it. And I've learned so much, you know, I feel like I take it as a learning opportunity, you know, my work has been
mm-hmm.
just a guiding force in that way in my life. I never get tired of people. I just don't, you know,
That is a gift.
Yeah.
I will say that's been my experience with you. You are so easy to open up to. I think there, that safe space, like I can't describe it, but there is a quality about you that it just feels so incredibly safe and very warm and very nurturing. And also like you're not afraid, like nothing is taboo to speak with you about. I feel like, you know, you're just welcoming to hear about any of it. You're not afraid to talk about, you know, death and dying, addiction, trauma, like it, mm-hmm. identity, like all of it is on the table. And there's just something that's so freeing about, even if, you know, you weren't trained, there's still that quality about you. I think you would be helping people no matter what. So anyway, well, I've taken up enough of your time.
Let me say this. Well, let me give you this last bit. I think it's important to touch on. I also think it's very essential for people to understand that suicidal ideation is a very real thing.
Yes.
And we don't need to be frightened to discuss that. If you feel like you cannot discuss that with your mental health clinician, you need to maybe find someone else, because that is a part of the healing process. It is very normal. I mean, I don't like to say normal, but it is not to be avoided and then allowed to become a crisis. Suicidal ideation is it is an opportunity for your clinician to not only hold that space for you, but also give you some very important information about what suicidal ideation means in your healing journey.
Right.
But to be frightened, and I mean, ideation is very different than plan and intent. Okay. And I think it's very important to highlight that.
Yeah.
But if you feel scared to bring that up, please don't. Please don't.
Yeah.
It's not like that isn't a part of.
Yeah. It can be so just relieving. I can't tell you how many times, seriously, that when we, you know, working it with elite warriors, they'll just pop by and be like, hey, I had this dream that I killed my wife and children. That's kind of freaking me out. Okay, let's talk about that. Because also when your body starts to feel that stress, like crazy dreams where you're killing everyone, that's not uncommon. So don't avoid these conversations. Don't let them isolate you from your teammates. Talk to your teammates, find the clinicians, but also suicidal ideation. So the thought of like, maybe this would just be much easier and better for everyone if I weren't here anymore. Also very common, lots of drive-bys. So you're right. Like, just don't hold it in. Mm-hmm. Find someone that you feel comfortable with, that you can talk about all of those things. Even if it's like popping in to say, hey, by the way, how normal or not normal is this?
Oh, 100%. Because I think people are frightened. Really. Yeah. I mean, I think, and I'm not saying it isn't. It is. Like, it's very
disturbing.
Dark. Mm-hmm. It's very dark. Yeah. And but don't
but
be
we're
alone.
In it together. Right.
That's not the time to be alone. You know, it's the time to kind of, with intention and mindfulness, bring people closer to you. Right. It doesn't have to be everybody, but it needs to be the people that can kind of show up best for you. And sometimes it is your buddies and sometimes it's not.
Sometimes it's not,
you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because we also have to realize that, again, everybody's got a lot of stuff they're carrying.
For sure. For sure. We could go on and on, Celeste. We really could.
Oh my God. I know.
I mean, like 1,000 things, but that's just from experience. And yet, like, you know, I just want people to hear that that struggle is just part of being human. There's no qualitative thing about it that makes you less than.
Yeah.
In fact, you know, it might just, I don't know. You might end up being proud of that struggle because it means you've faced some difficult things. Yeah. So I want to thank you so much for just like the presence here today, obviously, and the presence in my own life, the service that you have really provided for your husband over those many years, your daughters, and then the courage to be in the field of mental health. You know, I just want to thank you for all of that.
Oh, thank you so much. What a lovely experience. It was so good.
Hey, everybody. Thank you for joining us for another incredible episode of In the Name of Service. If you enjoyed today's episode, please like and subscribe. And of course, feel free to share with those you feel would like to be inspired. Have a difference maker in your life that you'd like to see featured? Reach out to Dr. Barb Thompson at inthenameofservice@gmail.com. We'll see you next time.